Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Many cities and towns across the U.S. have had to reinvent themselves or at least change their focus if they wanted to be successful. In the last 40 years, residents and businesses have moved to the suburbs, taking jobs along with them. Crime often increased, and urban schools found it difficult to compete. But a growing number of cities and towns have made comebacks. James and Deborah Fallows traveled the country, exploring some that are thriving and others with a ways to go before they're back. They chronicled what they found in the best-selling book, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. The Fallows recently appeared at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg, where we had the opportunity to discuss the book and what they found in their travels. Welcome to Harrisburg in Central Pennsylvania.
Thank you so much.
There are a lot of ideas in this book for a city like Harrisburg, and actually a number of cities here in Central Pennsylvania. Our Town's 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. What gave you the idea for traveling across the country and then writing about it?
You want to start, Deb?
Sure, I'll start. We'd been living in China for about 4 or 5 years before we set out on this adventure. And while we were in China, we spent a lot of time going around to small cities and towns around the country as much as we could, by train, by horseback, by airplane, by car, and really felt when we got out of the main cities, we lived in Beijing and Shanghai, that we got to know the country so much better and got to see how people really lived and what people were really like. It was a tremendous adventure. When we came back to the U.S., we'd been back about a year or two and were kind of grumpy because we felt like we were really out of touch with our own country. In about 2011, a lot had happened. The recession had come and was still trailing on. And we had also always, before we went to China, enjoyed and had the privilege of flying around in this tiny plane that we have to lots of different towns around the country. And we're amazed at all the at what we found that we had never known. It was a very humbling experience. So while we were grumpy, one of our sons said to us, well, why don't you just get back in that plane and do what you did in China? Go around to all the towns around the country to get back in touch with what you think is really going on and see what happens. So that was, after 18 years of raising that one child, we thought, great, payoff, good idea.
And you recognized that, too. So, Jim, what were you looking for when you decided to take on this odyssey?
So, as Deb was saying, we were looking mainly to see what was happening initially. And I'll say by a prelude, it's great to be back here, both in this region of the country. I have landed in our little Cirrus in your local airport a number of times. The plane was often maintained at the Lancaster Airport, not far away from here. And this is my native state. I was born in Philadelphia. My mom and dad both grew up in Jenkintown outside Philadelphia. I grew up in California, but this is where I was born. And what we wanted to, the whole theory of reporting is it's about what you didn't know until you went there, until you showed up. And so we thought to try to go to towns that were not normally on the media landscape unless there was a disaster. If there was a flood or a shooting or a hurricane or a political race, and where national reporters come and say, well, do you like Hillary? Do you like Trump? Do you like Obama? How do you feel about this or that? But instead, we wanted to see what would it be like to approach smaller town America as if it were a real place, where with its own concerns for what was better, what was getting worse. Deb and I are both small town people originally, small town Ohio for Deb, small town inland California for me, which is the crucial distinction in California, the coast versus inland. And so we thought, let's go back to places like where we are from and see if you just ask them about the dynamics of the town, would it be better? Would it be worse? So we didn't have a hypothesis to test initially. We developed one over time, but it was mainly just the reportorial instinct. What's it like?
How did you choose the towns, though?
I mean, because you know, one of the things that you can take away from this book is that it's overwhelmingly positive. And I mean, there are a few places. When you talk about inland California, like San Bernardino, we'll talk about that. But how did you choose these cities and towns?
You can tell the process, and I'll tell a theme.
Okay. Jim put a short post on the Atlantic's website and said what we were planning to do, and asked people for nominations of their towns, if their town had an interesting story to tell, and particularly if there was something going on in that town, if they had some hard times, like the mine closed or the mill closed or the factory closed. What was happening then? What were they doing to overcome that or not? Was anything going on? Good story, bad story. And within about a week, we got nearly 1,000 responses from people who wrote in, not just come to my town, but come to my town and here's the story, these long essays. So at that point, we thought, maybe we're onto something here. You know, there was such a strong response to it, and thematically.
And so we went all over the country. You know, it wasn't a scientific sample, but we were in every corner of the country, places with different ethnic mixes, a lot of time in Mississippi, times in South Dakota. In Pennsylvania, the two places we spent most time were Allentown, you know, which has been through all the changes you know in Allentown, and Erie, where we spent a lot of time at the end of our process. And I guess thematically on the positivity point you make, I'm going to give you a piece of actual data, although that's not my strength, and then I'll circle back to the reportorial part. Just a week ago, the American Enterprise Institute in D.C., which is a conservative-oriented and reputable think tank, reported the results of a big, nationwide, robust, thorough survey they'd done over the past year. And most of the reporting was in the summer of 2018, before the midterm elections, lots of strife in the country. And they found that by a very powerful margin, people were pessimistic about the country itself, national government especially, but also the country. But by more than a 3-to-1 margin, people across the country felt their own communities were improving. They felt as if, you know, that they all had problems, opioids, economic dislocation, all the other things you know about, but the direction was positive by like 75% of the people across racial groups, across regions, across political orientations and all the rest. And that was the impression we got to, that we went to places that were increasingly troubled. You know, Mississippi has its troubles. And San Bernardino, where we just were for the last 3 weeks doing a film project, is arguably the most troubled town in the country right now. And you know of its travails in western Kansas, where we were. But wherever cities were on sort of the objective good versus bad scale for today's position, most places felt as if the direction was positive rather than negative. Most places felt as if they were finding ways to make long-term plans, deal with the challenges of the moment. So that was the we chose them in a unsystematic but representative way, and felt as if there was a message of positive direction we were increasingly getting.
The national narrative that we hear almost every day today, and it's very noticeable, is that this is a country divided along partisan lines, so many issues that we're divided on. But something you mentioned in the book, and I think it relates to what you were saying about people being positive about their own towns, is that most people, when they talked about issues, they didn't talk about national issues, did they?
So I will start on this one, and then Deb can give you the real point. It was impressive to us. We've all seen the stories in the papers and the TV news of nation divided as never before. That is true for one layer of the country. I mean, and it's a significant layer, the layer of national politics that really is in bad situation. And we know that people have operated in separate fact universes, and that's a real issue. But if it's taken as being the country itself is profoundly divided, that is not what we found. And the simplest way to illustrate it is that we spent a lot of time in two cities that on the national grid are polar opposites. One is Greenville, South Carolina. I don't know if any of you have been there. It's a fabulous city. You know, it's very cultured and has this wonderful downtown, just a great, beautiful city. The other is Burlington, Vermont, you know, also a great city. Greenville, very conservative. Trey Gowdy has been the congressman for the last while. It was the last county of the last state to recognize Martin Luther King's birthday. Romney carried it like 30 points over Obama, et cetera. Burlington, the opposite extreme. You know, the parties are the Democrats and the socialists in the race for the mayor's office. But what struck us is that if you didn't know those national issues, you would think they were twin cities, that they worked the same way, that the city government with the NGOs, with the churches, with the companies, with the refugees, with everything else. And we had a wonderful moment of introducing the mayor of Greenville, Knox White, a 10-term Republican, to the mayor of Burlington, Moreau Weinberger, who's sort of in the lineage of Bernie Sanders, and they became fast friends because they had so much to discuss about the ways in which their cities worked the same way if you didn't ask, what about the midterms? What about the primaries?
But also, you know, we talked about this a lot while we were flying around and going to different cities of how much better people worked with each other across party lines. It wasn't even like political. They were just there to solve their problems. And one thing that was really became clear to us, I think it's not really surprising, but when you're in a small place, you know you're going to see your neighbors morning, noon, and night. You'll see them at the PTA. You'll see them when you're hauling your trash cans out. You'll see them at the grocery store. So it's kind of a self-imposed behavior. You better be nice because people are watching. And so that kind of accountability to your neighbors, and you know, they all need each other. You need each other to get the local problems done. It's not going to be done across party lines. It's going to be done because you all need the same thing. So you have to come to a way to come to find a way to solve the problems. And you want your kids to get along. So just that proximity of knowing your neighbors, being with your neighbors, finding yourselves with your neighbors is just very different from when you go into the polling booth or when you talk about national politics that is so far removed that you feel like maybe a participant, but and much more of an observer and less a participant than you are in your own town.
Did you witness that firsthand where people who were cooperating, if a national issue came up and they had to talk about it, that maybe a wall went up?
It's interesting. Again, we were careful never, ever to ask people national political questions, partly because the cliche of a national publication reporter going to a smaller town is you just go into a diner and say, how angry are you? What kind of hat are you wearing, et cetera. We didn't want to do that. Also, it's because our feeling was you never learned anything if you asked national politics. It just was, you all know the range of arguments on one side or the other. The way in which we actually saw the intersection of the two realms is a sort of cognitive dissonance realm. And I'll give two very quick examples. One is we were in Wyoming the day after the 2016 presidential election. And Wyoming had the second highest Trump percentage of any state after West Virginia. And so we were at some event there in Cheyenne the first day, then Laramie. And the people, they were, on the one hand, really relieved that the election had turned out the way it had, but also saying, well, let's hope NAFTA is not upset. Let's hope that the immigration policy is not upset because our economy depends on NAFTA here in Wyoming and our labor force depends on immigration. And so there was a sense of, in cultural signaling, they wanted the election to go the way it did. But in terms of practical effects, they were a little wary of that. The other illustration, which I'll just give one of many potential ones, is from Dodge City, Kansas, in western Kansas, which is Any of you have seen Gunsmoke? It's filmed in Dodge City. They still have all this, they have daily sort of mock shootouts downtown from the Gunsmoke, the saloon. And the tourists are mainly German because Gunsmoke is run in Germany now, so you have all these German tourists. But its business basis now is meatpacking. And it's the majority, it's a town with a mainly Anglo power structure and a majority Latino population and overwhelmingly Latino school district. And it was interesting that the sentiments of the town, again, were conservative Republican, but after both the 16 and 18 elections, there were a lot of efforts to shore up the school system with its mainly Latino districts. And many of you may have seen stories just before the midterm elections that the polling place in Dodge City was being moved out of downtown, that is away from a lot of Latino population centers. And that was a state government and county government decision. The city government of Dodge City, the day after that ruling, which and the city government, city council is all older white people, they voted a measure to provide free door-to-door transportation for all people in Dodge City to this new remote polling place, and put out a statement saying, "This is the new Dodge City. We all need each other. We're proud of what our city is becoming, and we want to protect everybody's right to vote." So we saw more sort of the cognitive dissonance of the cultural signaling of national politics, but the practicality of how the local life worked.
I want to add one other thing about this that sometimes we have to remind ourselves of. We started this project in 2013, which seems like 1,000 years ago in many ways. But the sensibility, the tone, the tenor of our conversations, of how we worked in the towns, of how people talked to us, remained pretty much the same from 2013 through the summer of 2016. During that time, we never brought up national politics. We were there to learn about the towns and what people were doing, so we'd talk about those questions. Interestingly, people never brought up national politics to us until it was the summer of 2016, and then that was what was on everyone's minds. But the kinds of conversations and the things that people wanted to talk about did not change during those 4 years, all the way up to, well, the end of 2016. So it is, you know, I would really like to underscore that what we found was consistent the whole time, and it was not, there was not a huge, overwhelming, suffocating sense of national politics over this whole thing. It was about the local.
You're listening to a pre-recorded discussion with James and Deborah Fallows, authors of Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. This is Smart Talk, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to this discussion of the best-selling book, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America, with authors James and Deborah Fallows. It was recorded at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg.
I'm going to go kind of backwards here. The very last chapter in the book, you list 10 characteristics of many of these places have made successful comebacks, but you listed 10 characteristics, keys to success. So let's go to the last chapter and talk about those keys to success before we talk about some of the specific places that you visited. What are some of the keys to success?
So I think I don't remember the exact sequence of the list. And to be clear, it's 10 and a half, you recall, the 10 and
that's
a half.
Right. Okay, I missed that point five.
Six. Wait, we'll get to the half point. But in various ways, all of these were aspects of local patriotism, local commitment, and a sense that people's lives were affected, that people weren't just consuming a community, but felt as if the world outside their front door really, really mattered to them. And I guess two I will mention of the list. I could go down the whole list, but the two that I would want to highlight before we get to the half. One is a sense of people knowing what I think of as the civic story, or what you could think of as the national myth. And the idea here is, you know, Deb and I have lived a lot of our life outside the United States, And the more you're outside the U.S., the more clearly you perceive what's unusual, better, and worse about the United States. And one of the clearest things about the U.S. from afar is the power of our national myth. Myth in the sense not that it's untrue, but that it's the guiding mythos of the new nation that's created, and it's not one ethnic group, but it's trying to become a more perfect union and people finding new lives and reinventing themselves. We know what's false about that, but we also know what's important about it, and the way that it guides a sense of what America should be. And lots of cities we went to had a clear understanding of what their national story, their national myth was, what they stood for originally, where they were now, and how their future ambitions fit into that national pattern. In my town of Redlands, California, a little town, it was the idea that its founders, who came both from Philadelphia and Boston and New York in the 1880s and 1890s, wanted to make it a cultured place, and that the new people who came in the 1930s and after that from the Dust Bowl and from Mexico, from other places, wanted to have this be a special city. And so that guides the way people behave now. And there's lots of other illustrations of the national story, the civic story. So that was one thing of people thinking it wasn't just where they happened to live or where they got a cheap real estate deal or where it was across the city line for taxes or whatever. It was a place that had a reason. The other... I'm going to mention two other points quickly. Another point that really struck us is that cities that were succeeding had deliberately made themselves open. They thought that our future depends on this being a place where people from outside could feel welcome, of different generations, of different religions, of different races, of different parts of the world. If they had a conscious effort to say, not elbows out, your grandparents weren't born here, so we don't, you don't want you. But a deliberate openness, which has been an American mark through, in imperfect ways through its history, is also a mark of most of the cities that we saw. A related point is, I became a believer in the power of community colleges and career technical education as being the crucial educational link in this stage of national history. I can give you the whole pitch on that later on, but places that where community colleges played a big role in their imagination mattered to us. And there are more on the list, but those are just a couple.
I'll just quickly go over the list, but I do want to talk about that half that you mentioned as well. A lot of cooperation amongst the people in a town, that they have downtowns that, if not thriving, they're on their way to thriving. They're looking ahead what they can do with their downtown. Local patriots, as you mentioned, innovative schools, near research universities or community colleges, public-private partnerships, and open to newcomers. The newcomers, I'll bet if we ask this whole room, we polled the room about Dodge City, Kansas, probably no one in this room would know that 70 to 80% of the school-age children in Dodge City, Kansas are immigrants, Latino. And you mentioned that Dodge City welcomes them. That, again, goes against kind of the national narrative today.
Yeah. To say one more point on this, there is probably no issue on which the national narrative more sharply differs from lived local level reality in our reporting experience than the immigration perspective. You know how bitter this national level discourse is right now, but our overwhelming experience is the only places that were really upset about the immigrant threat are places where there weren't any immigrants. It's significant that the congressmen, Republican, congressional representatives, Republican, Democratic, from every place that borders Mexico are not interested in a wall, and that the plains states and industrial Midwest have very, very significant Latino populations now. And most of these places think this is the future of their communities. And you can tell about Erie.
Or I can tell about Sioux Falls.
Oh, yeah.
Which... Sioux Falls, South Dakota, who knew? You know, you think of it like you think of Dodge City, old shoot 'em up place. You think of Sioux Falls in South Dakota as from its Germanic and Nordic culture. 10% of the school population in Sioux Falls are refugees. Sioux Falls started to take refugees into their town in the 70s with Vietnam, and they have rolled over and become really good, almost professional, at accepting refugees. Wave after wave after wave. There are about 60 different languages in the public schools. They work at this in an amazing granular level, and each time it's different with each new wave of immigrants that comes in. For example, one day in the schools, in the high school, they were realizing that it was Ramadan. Muslim kids were fasting, and it seemed like cruel and unusual punishment to make these kids go sit in the cafeteria and watch everyone else eat while they were fasting. So somebody said, well, let's just give these kids a separate room where they can go be together and not have to watch people eat their hot dogs, probably, in the meatpacking industry. And that is just the kind of small but critical element that happens when you've got every time a new kind of population coming in that you have to reinvent. You have to pay attention to your problems and reinvent your answers or solutions to those anew each time. And in Sioux Falls and Erie, which also is 10% of the population is refugees.
The entire population of Erie, 10% refugee.
So it makes a huge, it's a huge impact on the town in just about every way, starting with economic. That one of the statements we heard in towns like Sioux Falls and Erie and Burlington were, as Jim said before, we need each other. We rely on each other. We are better for this. So it's that mindset of from the struggle comes rewards, and that ultimately this is a positive effort from which we all profit.
All right, so you've seen Jim laugh about this a little bit with the 10 and a half. I will add a little story of my own. I interviewed a woman who was the head of a downtown organization, and she said that one of the keys to developing your downtown, making it successful, is a craft brewery. There you go. So you have your own way of, that's one of the ways you, I don't know if I'd say graded, but if you could tell if a town was successful or not.
This is the half point, the 10 and a half points of success. Are there craft breweries? And this is, you know, it's a favorite for me because I love craft breweries and craft beer. It's actually a serious point in this way. There are two personal connections to this. One is that I worked long ago for Jimmy Carter, former president of the United States. And one of the things that Carter did, in the same deregulatory mode that gave us the current airline system, for better and worse, he also deregulated home brewing. And that was the beginning of craft brewing in the U.S., or the renaissance of it. In the mid-1800s, basically every city had its own brewery because there was no refrigeration. So you had to have your own locally made beer. It couldn't travel. After Prohibition, the number of breweries in the United States went into the mid-double digits. There were only 50 or 60 in the entire United States because it was so concentrated after Prohibition. Now, I think we're in the 6,000 or 7,000 range. There's been this proliferation of breweries everywhere. It's a serious employer in the hundreds of thousands of employees. It's a very important lever for downtown, you know, attracting people downtown along with arts and other things that gets people there. And it's part of the localism movement and food and everything. So it's both a benefit to the country and a serious thing. And one of Deb's college classmates was Jim Cook, the founder of Sam Adams Beer. So your reunions are always
great. It always beer flows, right? Yeah. But for Midtown Scholar Books, yeah. There may be a challenge coming. We were really surprised to find in Duluth that one of the craft breweries that we visited in 2013 or 14, we went back a few years later to say, okay, how's it going? And found that they'd moved across the street to this giant place. And in the back of their brewery, they had all these public spaces where they were having book events and writers' events. Yes. So it's, you know.
And the kids, you can't get the kids into breweries early enough. So they had
kids that's right.
Too.
They had whole play sections like libraries do where, you know, the kids were hanging out.
You can see this going wrong.
Well, you did say they were innovative.
Yes.
Let's talk about some of the cities specifically. You mentioned Greenville, South Carolina. I got the sense from reading the chapter on Greenville that you were very impressed.
We,
yeah.
Yeah, we were.
How many of you have been there to Greenville?
And we were impressed by its recent history when anybody in Greenville who had been away for 15 years had come back and just said, whoa, they didn't recognize this place. The old downtown by the river was, you wouldn't dare go there after dark. It was decrepit. It was dangerous. It was, you know, full of, you know what, everything bad. And now it's just a thriving, beautiful place. And there were a lot of steps that we admired in how Greenville did this. There was patience to start with, that this wasn't going to be an overnight success. But it was a combination of the public-private partnerships, of the attention from the arts community towards adding that different perspective, of turning around, of moving a highway, taking the bridge out, opening up the falls, which had been covered by a traffic bridge.
Can I interrupt for just 1 second? Because that's a big part of their success. I got this. They actually had a bridge that covered, that people couldn't see the falls. So they tore down a bridge. Yeah. I mean, this bridge, there was nothing wrong with it, right?
The mayor, Knox White, very early in his term, he said that people ridiculed him for saying, you're going to destroy a perfectly good freeway bridge. And he said, yeah, but, and of course, now it looks like a stroke of genius. But then it was very, very controversial.
And they have, now they have a gorgeous, I'm sure architecturally incredibly famous pedestrian bridge that crosses over the falls. And it is absolutely a feature, which brings us to another great thing they did, was that the river walk was all kudzu and mosquitoes and horrible, you know, along the river. You wouldn't even dare go there before they had this new pedestrian bridge and the reconfiguration of the highway over the river. Now they have a wonderful river walk, which is wonderful for a bunch of reasons. It's really a place where everybody can get together. Along that river walk, partly it's kind of rubbery where all the older people walk, partly it's a great biking path, partly you see moms and dads with strollers and lots of French and German being spoken there because it's Michelin and BMW. It's their headquarters now. And the dog walkers, which brings everybody out to mix and mingle, a special place for the dogs to go and everything. But we started to laugh at one point when another of the 10.5 points, that every town, even if it didn't have a river, had a river walk. The equivalent of a river walk. It was a place, the same idea, the same theme, that this is where people would go and enjoy themselves and find people who weren't necessarily like them, but everybody was in a good mood and kind of mixed and mingled and provided the excuse for that to happen.
You also wrote about the Governor's School for the Arts. And again, I think if a lot of people look at stereotypes, they don't think of South Carolina as this would be a hotbed for that. But this was in a distressed area, correct?
You can tell about that and also A.J. Wittenberg.
Yeah. Okay. So when we got to Greenville, we started asking, as we did in other places, can you tell me an interesting school we should go visit? Because it was always exciting and fun and creative to see what kind of schools people were making in their towns. And in Greenville, we could have stayed there for 3 weeks and seen a great, interesting school each time. The Governor's School for the Arts and Humanities, there are about 20 states that have these governor's schools. They are public boarding schools, usually either for arts and humanities or for math and science. We went to another in Mississippi, which is a fabulous. The idea is that you go out and see kids from the third bend in the river or the bayous or the deltas or the shacks and chanties, and you draw in these kids and give them an opportunity to have the kind of education and chance that they wouldn't necessarily have in their hometowns, and turn these kids around and send them off to, you know, Juilliard and RISD and to make Pritzker awards and on to fabulous careers. The school that probably impressed us one of the most in Greenville, South Carolina, it's called the Just a little background. So Greenville had turned itself around from a failed textile town into new industry from BMW, Michelin, GE, big high-tech heavy industry towns. And part of the effort in that town in the public-private partnerships was the industry saying, look, we've got to train our next generation of employees in this town. And the town saying, we really need to work on our schools. So they got together and decided with a strong input in the curriculum and design from all these big engineering companies to build in a very distressed part of town the A.J. Wittenberg Elementary School of Engineering. And this was little tiny kids, pre-K through grades four, who were learning engineering as kind of the mode of everything else. And the volunteers were from all these companies. They'd come in, teach kids about light bulbs, you know, how to make things fly, do whatever you do in engineering. And it became... obviously, I'm not an engineer myself. Sorry. I didn't go to one of those. No, I didn't have them. I went to, you know, Christ the King Elementary School. We didn't study that. it developed into such a pathway for all the public schools in Greenville that they went on to make a middle school and introduce into this engineering curriculum the arts, because they all decided, okay, you've nailed it. These kids are going to be great, but let's teach them how to write, how to read, how to argue, how to debate, how to manage and maximize their soft skills. So when they get into these engineering companies, they will have the basics, but they will also have what makes them good managers, good creative thinkers, and good participants in whatever this industry is going to look like in 20 years.
You're listening to a pre-recorded discussion with James and Deborah Fallows, authors of Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. This is Smart Talk, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to this discussion of the best-selling book, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America, with authors James and Deborah Fallows. It was recorded at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg.
So when you wrote about Greenville, you received a letter, if I have this story correct, from Mississippi. And whatever ranking you look at, job-wise, income, educational attainment, Mississippi is down near the bottom. But you saw something in Mississippi, not just something, but some things in Mississippi that had to be surprising.
Yes. They have the governor's school. It's a Mississippi School for Math and Science, which is based in Columbus. And what they do in this town of Columbus, which was a Civil War hospital, all the casualties from the Battle of Shiloh went down to Columbus. Lots of people were buried there from both armies, is they have their student body, black and white and others, do recreation of all the stages in that city's history, the slavery stage and the Reconstruction stage and the Civil Rights stage, and just is as engaged and honest a reckoning with American history as we have seen any place in northeastern Mississippi with a racially very diverse population.
So one thing that you said at the start of this was how we got to Mississippi. Yeah. You're right. When we had written in a blog post about the governor's school in South Carolina, one day I got an email in my inbox, and it was from the English teacher at this Mississippi School for Math and Science, and he was essentially saying, look, you think that governor's school is so great. You got to come to Mississippi and see our governor's school. So, you know, we thought, how can we not do that? So we went to Mississippi. But it turned out to be a real lesson in how this whole journey evolved. When I hear us talking about it now, it sounds like it was a really well-planned journey. But in fact, it was very much more haphazard and hit or miss. So we went to Mississippi looking for that school, and we ended up finding this $5 billion of new industry in the Golden Triangle of Mississippi. Who's heard of this? Yeah. We never heard of this. So you go looking for a school, and you find
Joe Max Higgins.
Joe Max Higgins, sheriff sent from Arkansas, and it's $5 billion of investment. That's more the actual flavor of how this 4 or 5 years in that little plane turned out. Mm.
Well, you mentioned that you went to two cities in Pennsylvania. One was Allentown, the other was Erie. You talked a little bit about Erie. Allentown was a success story, other than the mayor going to jail. We'll talk about that later.
Yes, yes.
You had nothing to do with that, right?
History will note that the people of Allentown reelected him easily to his fourth term when he was under multiple indictments. And it was after that he was convicted, et cetera.
But
he was
lucky.
We noted all of the complications of his reputation. He's the only person who he wrote about who is now in prison.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, that's right.
But Allentown has made a comeback.
What was interesting to us is that the popular image of Allentown, of course, is the steel industry decline, and of course, as you probably all know here as Pennsylvanians, the bitter lament from the people of Allentown is the steel mill that Billy Joel was writing about was actually in Bethlehem, right? but Billy Joel couldn't find a rhyme for Bethlehem, so it was because he could have a rhyme for Allentown that it was the song became about Allentown. But the regional economy has actually recovered pretty well because of locational advantages with New York and Philadelphia and all the rest. The problem was specifically for Allentown, the downtown. And so they have had this very ambitious plan over the last 10 years to have this neighborhood improvement zone or some tax scheme to bring the downtown back. So we were recording the way in which the downtown was trying to reconstitute itself. And that seems so far to have been working out apart from the mayor's difficulties.
Yeah, that's a state program. Yeah. And as you write in the book, the mayor is a Democrat and Senator Pat Brown, a Republican, combined on it. And something that many of us here from central Pennsylvania, or really anywhere in eastern Pennsylvania, recognize, everyone pointed to the closing of Hess's department store in downtown when Allentown started having some troubles. They actually branched out. There were some Hess's department stores out in this area as well. Something that was interested in, though, narrowing of the streets.
Yes, this was one of many of the counterintuitive things we heard. So we all would assume that pedestrian malls are the way to bring life to downtowns because, people being downtown is the way to have things go. You would say, people walking around going to the stores, going to the brew pubs, going to the bookstores, going to all the rest. But apparently, current urbanism says you need to bring cars back to a certain degree. That was something that Greenville was actually a pioneer of, where they had some purely pedestrian areas, and they found that it choked off the life. So you need to have cars being there and have it be relatively easy to park on the street, not in big parking structures. And the place so Greenville has now studied. An actual problem for Greenville is they have study groups from around the world going there every single day, going to see what their downtown looks like and how they brought back a certain amount of car traffic. And Fresno, the city of Fresno, California, I don't know if many of you have been there. It's not a stylish part of California, I can say, being from the interior myself. But they are remaking their downtown. They closed essentially all of their downtown to traffic 50 years ago with this very, very early pedestrian-only mall, which then cut off all the life to the downtown. So they're bringing traffic back in narrow streets that are big enough for cars, but still not really intimidating to cross.
One of the things you learned with Allentown is that Pennsylvania has more municipalities than any state in the country. We have about 2,500 municipalities, and Allentown, one of the issues that Allentown faced was Bethlehem and the surrounding municipalities. But moving on to Erie, something else you discovered is that Pennsylvania does not have the best, maybe has the worst, funding of schools, and Erie really has suffered from it.
Yes. So speaking as a Pennsylvania native, I can say that, two real problems for our state are this proliferation of little boroughs and taxing jurisdictions. So my other home state of California has, what, three times, four times as many people and only about a quarter as many jurisdictions as Pennsylvania does. It's a much huger state than Pennsylvania. So that is something that is a problem here. And in Erie is a really dramatic illustration because the school funding there is all balkanized. So the city of Erie itself has essentially a whole lot of non-taxable property, universities and public buildings, and a whole lot of poor people. That's essentially the city of Erie. And most of the richer people have moved across the borough lines outside. So that, and so that is, you'll recall a couple of years ago, the city of Erie threatened to close all its high schools just because it couldn't support them and throw its students upon the mercy of the state of the surrounding neighborhoods. Apparently, in Pennsylvania, there's no requirement to go to public school beyond like age 14 or something, and so Erie could do this legally. So I think this is, as a Pennsylvanian, I would be looking for ways to equalize school funding and try to blow up some of the little borough structure, but I guess that's easier to say than to do.
So Deborah, did you swim in Lake Erie? There's a reason for asking this question,
yeah.
By the way.
Well, I grew up on Lake Erie in Ohio. Yes.
So it's like coming
home.
So
yes. That was, yes, I swam my whole life in Lake Erie. But as I think probably what you're getting at here is part of Jim's drinking all that beer when we were in the craft breweries and all those hours we spent in the plane, we had to kind of, you know, work it off somehow and get out there and exercise. So I am a swimmer, having grown up on Lake Erie. So it was part of my mission to swim somewhere in every town we went to. And I found how actually easy that was and what I learned from it. Not only was it a really fun experience, but the YMCAs, which are just about in every town, were a wonderful, strong public institution where you could pay $5 or $10 as a guest, go into the swimming pool, and get a sense of the town that we wouldn't otherwise get. So I really came to value, who knew again, the experience of going swimming everywhere, from the Snake River in Idaho, which was a little scary, to the YMCAs in you know, Sioux Falls, you name it, just everywhere I can tell you.
Were there other places in these cities that you visited that people wouldn't necessarily think of that you could learn something from?
About libraries.
The libraries, absolutely, for sure. Yeah, I am kind of embarrassed to say it took us a while to figure out we should go into libraries. Like, why would you go into libraries? I had thought of them, assumed they were pretty much like when we were kids or when our kids were kids. Completely different situation now. It's all about education, it's all about technology, and it's all about social and civic opportunities. The libraries filling in the gaps, both from what's needed in the town, be it ESL classes or citizenship classes, to what people want in the town, like, teach me how to do the tango, or let's do yoga at the libraries, to helping people find jobs or lending not only books, but in Burlington, Vermont, lending shovels in the winter. So kids go in there and borrow a shovel and make a little money shoveling people's sidewalks. Or fishing poles in my hometown, where you can do that. Or hotspots, which you can take with you to the basement of the church where you can't get internet and get internet for some meetings that you need. We became complete fans and advocates for libraries, and have noticed over the last couple years, you know, librarians used to say, we are the best kept secret, and we don't want to be that best kept secret in America. And now they've stopped saying that so much. I think word is getting around that's an important place to go and an institution to support.
Real quickly, how many cities did you visit, and what's the takeaway?
I'll do the easy part. We wrote about two dozen cities.
And we plan to keep traveling and keep writing and keep connecting. The takeaway, I think, is that there is what Americans would like to think of as a recognizable version of the national character still exists in most places where people actually live. The more people are aware of that, the more possibility it is that the brighter rather than darker parts of our national character will emerge.
Well, that's good to hear. That is good to hear. James and Deborah Fallows, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.